Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. This week's news included let's just say that being able to back off and save face is not just a political thing. You actually have to do it in science as well. And so this month led to the publishing of a really important backing off by the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. At their December meeting, there was a lot of discussion about menopause and therapy for menopause. And I remember so clearly in 2002 when a story was broken. It was one of the first times that researchers had actually gone and done a press conference and presented their information before it was published and sent to doctors. So everybody was caught flat-footed in the field because this is earlier in the days of the internet. And we couldn't get to the article. We couldn't even get to the electronic version for a full 24 hours. And doctors all over the country were traumatized. They were flooded by hordes of frantic women who had just read front page news that their hormone replacement therapy was going to give them breast cancer. And it was finally, proven. Well, fast forward a couple of years, part two of the study comes out, and it turns out, actually, not so much. In fact, the group that took only equine estrogen, that's to say the horse pee version of estrogen, had less cancer. Well, that sort of argues that there was a statistical artifact in there, and yes, indeed there was. But it has become absolute gospel among easily half of physicians, in spite of tons of data to the contrary, that hormone replacement therapy is bad for you. This study was called the Women's Health Initiative, and the people who participated in it went on to have stellar careers just re-massaging and repurposing their very bad data and giving speeches and publishing and getting lots of grant funding. And one good unintended consequence of all that grant funding was a whole lot of research went into women's health and showed, well, among other things, that newly menopausal women are at risk for all sorts of diseases: obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, chronic arthritis, dementia, cognitive decline, depression, and cancer. So there are many, many studies. We can go back to the early 90s and find studies showing that hormone replacement therapy reduces the risk of coronary artery disease. In fact, the risk reduction was over 50%. It also reduces the risk of fracture. It was also shown that it increased the risk of breast cancer. We've since done a lot of work on that, and we find that it's a subgroup of people. And remember, all of these early studies are done with forms of estrogen that are rarely used nowadays. Subsequent to the 2002, a whole bunch of women went off estrogen, and we started seeing increased rates of heart disease, increased risks of dementia, obviously more osteoporosis. And the most important thing to understand here is that there's been a ton of research coming out in the last decade. And at this point, suddenly it's like, oh, well, we have new information. Actually, we also had old information. People just got hysterical. And it is a very sad thing because many women's health was hurt because their doctors were afraid of being sued and afraid of being criticized. And in nowadays, for example, I will point out Kaiser, their doctors are actively discouraged from giving women hormone replacement therapy. And I've talked to doctors there who simply refuse to do it. They aren't even interested in having a discussion about it. They are extremely reluctant. That flies in the face of the data that shows benefits. For example, Alzheimer's. If you start hormone replacement within 5 years of menopause, there's a 30% reduced risk of Alzheimer's. This comes from a study of 1,700 women. It was published in Neurology in 2012, the October issue. Doesn't work if you wait more than 5 years to start those hormones. You don't get the benefit. Same thing for the heart disease. That's one of the things that messes it up, is you have to define your study group carefully. Otherwise, the older women who start hormone therapy water down the benefits for the younger women, and it doesn't turn out to be statistically significant. In terms of symptoms, you know, one of the things that happens is that when you go through menopause, your sleep is affected and your cognition is affected, often for years, and your quality of life goes down. And there is not a health benefit to going through a natural menopause if you are having those symptoms, and there may in fact be a health hit from going through. So the key point to take home here is make up your mind either right at menopause or before menopause. Do your reading, do your research. There's lots of data that show that 17-beta-estradiol is cardiac protective. Now, that's the natural hormone replacement. The best way to give that, by the way, is to give it topically, and there are patches and creams that work very well. They're also much lower dose than the stuff that we were using back in the 90s, which was oral and literally 10 times stronger. That led to an increased risk of blood clots. Subsequent studies showed that the topical preparations like the patches do not carry an increased risk of blood clots, and that is a very solid finding that makes a lot of sense biologically, because the liver is what makes the blood clotting hormones, and the liver is what has to churn through all of that oral estrogen, and it affects the production of the blood clotting. Estrogen is protective for the formation of plaque. It's protective, and these effects happen best early. Maybe after 10 years, you can stop taking them. Maybe after 10 years, you should. There's some evidence that long-term benefit is a case of diminishing returns. But I think that's probably related to the statistics of increasing frequency of heart disease in women, because it is the major cause of women. And the fact that women who are on hormone replacement therapy and get breast cancer tend not to have breast cancers that kill them, because they're getting the vigilance in order to get the prescription. They're getting those mammograms. And so their cancers are being caught early. And there may not be an increased amount of cancers. It may just be more cancers, because the ones that are, well, let's say the woman dies of a heart attack, no one's going to go looking for a breast cancer. If your heart attacks go up without the estrogen, if they go down with it, well, then your breast cancers are going to go up with the estrogen, because you're going to find those ones that the person would have died before you could have found. It's really clear that we need to rethink hormone replacement therapy and ask serious questions in our research and careful questions about timing. But for now, I'm feeling very vindicated. I think it's in the archives if you go way, way back. But there was a program I did in late 2002 saying exactly this. If you read this study that is being trumpeted to the roofs as proof, it's really not proof. Oh, one little benefit I forgot to mention, a substantially reduced risk of colon cancer in women using the old Women's Health Initiative. I don't know whether or not that colon cancer benefit is dependent on taking it orally, and I haven't seen any research on that for a while, so I'll go hunt for it, and I'll get back to you on that one. Starting with Sherry from Minneapolis. Sherry writes, Hashimoto's thyroiditis. I'm a 40-year-old woman with subclinical hypothyroidism. My primary care docs thinks it's probably Hashimoto's. My question, what lifestyle changes can I make in order to decrease the likelihood of experiencing symptoms in the future? I'm curious about cutting out gluten, which I'm finding conflicting information about. Other info, my TSH is 5.3. It's a little high. I wouldn't treat that unless the person was deeply symptomatic, parenthetically speaking. T3 and 3.4 are well within normal limits. And 2 years ago, I was postpartum and losing my mind due to profound insomnia and nursing problems. And my TPO, that's thyroid peroxidase antibodies, folks, were elevated. My primary care doctor isn't interested in testing those levels again. Why do I think she's in an HMO? Anyway, I am not experienced any significant symptoms of hypothyroidism. I'm not experiencing major stress. I don't have notable digestive problems, and my diet and exercise are pretty good. My doctor gave me the option of taking Synthroid. I decided not to, since I'm not having any issues. Good move, Sherry. I would not advise that. And thank you for your thoughts. I really hope to hear from you. I've been listening to your podcast for over 10 years. Your show was the first podcast I listened to regularly. Well, thank you, Sherry. We've been podcasting since 2004, and I totally appreciate that compliment. Let's start with the gluten issues. I've got a couple specific bits of advice for you. One of them is, yes, I think you should stop eating gluten. It turns out there's a lot of mistaken identity between gluten, which looks like some of the body proteins that are on the surface of our own bodies. They're technically glycoproteins, same sort of things that blood type are based on. They are histocompatibility antigens, technically. And the problem is the immune system can recognize them and sometimes gets primed to do that. We've all heard of rheumatic heart disease. That's where strep bacteria primes our immune system to attack a molecule that's found on our own heart valves. Oops. In the case of gluten, gluten looks a lot like something called tissue transglutaminase. Tissue transglutaminase is a marker. It's a glycoprotein, and it's found on the surface of a lot of tissues, but most significantly, it's found on your thyroid. If you start making antibodies to gluten, which people can do even if they don't have celiac disease, but you might start making some anti-TTG antibodies. And if you start making those, you might start attacking your thyroid. And if you start attacking your thyroid, you might start making TPO as well, because the immune system sees the injured thyroid and then starts attacking other antigens in a case of friendly fire that can lead to autoimmune disease. You know, friendly fire, like that's a war thing where you get killed by your side because they think you're the other guy. Well, that's kind of what's happening in autoimmune disease. I guess I've got a lot of war in my mind tonight. Let's just keep rolling with this. So first thing, I would stop eating gluten. I would get my gut garden in shape, maybe get some testing. Genova has a test called GIFX that looks at your microbiome. Make sure you've got lots of good bacteria in there. And if your good bacteria's levels are low or there's other abnormalities, then yeah, you probably want to do something about it. Now, you're way over in Minneapolis, and there I don't do long distance medicine for people in that setting, but you probably can find a functional medicine doctor in Minneapolis with no problems at all. So go to functionalmedicine.org and put in your zip code and find someone who's certified, and they'll be able to help you with that. Make sure your stress is reduced. If you haven't taken up meditation, do so, or some sort of art. Art for me is my meditation. But the point is, getting your mind into the now and feeling warm and cozy while you're there talks your immune system off the ledge and causes it to relax. And when you are in periods of high stress, it's extremely important to immunize yourself against worsening of your autoimmune disease. And that means, by the way, learn to meditate or learn a good relaxation response and use it when you're not under stress so that it's there when you need it. Next situation, which is monitoring your free T4. We want you to keep your levels in the normal range. And when you have unusual fatigue, particularly feeling cold, it's time to get rechecked. I wanted to talk about also something that might explain why your TSH is elevated, but your T3 and your T4 are within normal limits. And that has to do with something called thyroid binding globulin, which we do not check for. The body's really smart. The liver's really smart. And so if your thyroid levels are kind of borderline, they're sort of wimpy, they're in the normal range, but it's not quite what your brain would like, your body will actually make less levels of the protein in your blood that binds thyroid hormone and keeps it inactive. So just like we have sex hormone binding globulin that grabs estrogen and testosterone, we have thyroid binding globulin that grabs thyroid. So if you're suddenly sick and a virus infects your thyroid and you dump a bunch of thyroid hormone into your system and get jittery, your body will suddenly start pumping out more thyroid binding globulin to try to compensate for that. The body's got a plan B for everything. And as I said, since we don't monitor that in these marginal cases like yours, it's not uncommon to see people who are doing just fine. It's also not uncommon to see people who have a normal TSH of 3 and are not doing just fine. And you have to dig down and check their T3 levels, and you'll find that those are low and their T4 is high. And that means they're not converting their T4 into T3. So there's all sorts of subtlety that isn't taught in medical school that we do learn in functional medicine, And we're going to help you out with that. So go ahead and try those things. And thank you so much for your long-term listenership. The next number that we're going to hit is number one over here to talk to Christine in Scotts Valley. Hello, Christine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hello there. What can I do for you tonight?
I have a question about deep tissue laser therapy and potential home options. So I've had a frozen shoulder, and I went to a clinic over the hill, and they had a deep tissue massage laser. It's not a massage. It's laser therapy. And it was very, very helpful. And I didn't want to keep driving over the hill, so I started researching home options, and I found all this stuff on, you know, infrared LED and infrared heating lamps, and I always research risks, and it turns out that it seems more complicated than one would think. And there's all these people, say, on Amazon buying these red light lamps, and apparently, you know, heating our tissues isn't such a great idea, but I'm not sure.
Not always.
I'd like to hear if you know anything about that and any potential red, you know, near infrared or far infrared home treatments that could be helpful in helping my shoulder heal.
Okay. That's an excellent question, Christine. Once upon a time, I was about 5 years old, and my mother said, okay, you're old enough, you can open this trunk. This is Grandpa's trunk, and it has some of Grandpa's things. And I opened Grandpa's trunks, and there was this really funny, weird light bulb in a cage. And I took it to my mom, and I'm like, well, this is pretty cool. It was kind of steampunk when I think back on it now. And I'm like, what is this, Mommy? And she's, oh, that's your grandfather's infrared lamp. Because he had arthritis in his knee, and he would put that infrared lamp on his knee, and it helped his pain. So it goes pretty far back, this idea. And the concept of tissue heating, among other things, it causes vasodilation, which means the blood vessels open up and you send more blood to the area. And that generally, when you've got an arthritic or a chronic condition, is good. Now, shoulder, frozen shoulder, is misunderstood and mischaracterized, actually, in my opinion. And the way it's described and the way I was taught to think about it, it's as if things get stuck together because you're not moving your shoulder, and that this is an adhesion phenomenon, like the adhesions that people get in their abdomen after surgery. I have reason to doubt that. The chief reason is that as an acupuncturist, I learned techniques that actually fixed frozen shoulder, and if it were adhesions, they shouldn't have worked. There is also a fix that they used to do, orthopedists used to do, which is they would put you under and they would manipulate your shoulder, and then you would have to keep moving it around and doing all these stretches. But it substantially reduced the frozen shoulder, and you could get back 30 or 45 degrees of arc. And, you know, if your shoulder can't get above two fists away from your rib cage, you can't reach over your head, you can't shampoo, there's all sorts of activities of daily living which are substantially compromised. So it's kind of a crappy thing to have. I'm pushing you in the direction of getting some acupuncture, because it can be really amazing to do this deep tissue. And what you're doing essentially is you're numbing up the shoulder so you don't have to put somebody under. And then you are needling areas of muscle spasm, and you're resetting the reflex, because what has actually happened in frozen shoulder is that you are protecting yourself from pain, and everything is super, super tense, and all the muscles are locked. And this seems to actually fix it a lot of the time. I have had my failures, but I'm pretty astonished. And acupuncture treatment for frozen shoulder is definitely a thing. It is deep needling, so it is painful, and it's important to see someone who's trained. If you're not up for something quite that drastic, and I understand, you know, I've used the word pain and deep needles, and those sound scary. So, first of all, how restricted is your range of motion, and what physical therapy are you doing?
I've done many different things. What has really helped was a combination of myofascial release, deep tissue laser, and Feldenkrais. Feldenkrais being extraordinarily helpful. And I had it completely fixed. And then I had that terrible bug this season, was sick for a month, coughing like crazy. And my left shoulder just started doing that thing again. And so I could go back over the hill and do the myofascial release.
Right. And you're just hoping to short circuit that. And I totally get that.
I got really fascinated with discovered all kinds of things about these red LED laser lights that seemed really interesting. And you may or may not want to answer that. And then I thought, they seem like it might be problematical. It's like not a cut and dried thing, you know, these self-help things that people do. So I'm very open. I love acupuncture. I hadn't thought of going and doing that. So I could do that. And I appreciate that feedback. There's, you know, I'm pretty good. Like I can go up 90 degrees. So
good.
I can't lift my shoulder higher than 90 degrees from my body. So
and are you doing stuff every day? Are you doing stuff every day that's like specifically stretching, slow stretching exercises, like the wall walk, you know, the itsy bitty spider thing and holding and holding a weight and doing the pendulum exercise. Are you doing those?
I'm not doing the pendulum, but I do stuff every day.
Yeah. Well, you may not be doing. Yeah. So I would say, I think Feldenkrais is awesome. And a lot of what it's doing, if you read, you know, their cognitive model of what the purpose is, what they're doing is they're retraining these reflex arcs. And I think, so it's like, all right. So they're approaching, they're seeing the problem as a reflex arc, which is how I see it. So I'm totally down with their approach. But you could absolutely try a red laser. That would be the one, not the blue laser. And my recommendation is if you decide to go that route, get someone to mark on your arm and take a picture of it, mark the major acupuncture points that are used for shoulder, or go get an acupuncture treatment and have them use a Sharpie and mark the points after they've treated you. And then you take a photo and and basically learn the landmarks. I mean, you can look up in an acupuncture anatomy book at the library. You can look up, you know, how is triple heater 15 or Sanjiao 15 found? You know, it's on the side of the deltoid ligament. How's large intestine 14 found? And so there are maps to all of these points, and you hit the major shoulder points with a red laser, and in rotation, maybe taking 15, 20 minutes to do that once a day and see what you get. Because it would work with needles.
Awesome. So what would the difference between like an LED light versus a near infrared one that gets a lot hotter? Does it matter?
Well, I typically, if you're using acupuncture points, you actually want to use a very gentle laser. So an LED, there are acupuncture lasers. They're probably, I have an industrial strength one, but it's not that strong. I mean, I can't burn anybody with it, which is exactly what you want. You don't want something you can hurt yourself with. The shoulder, if you're muscular or very overweight, you might want to, you could use the infrared one, but the infrared's going to spread through the tissues and it's just going to give you more generalized heating. And that's not a bad thing, but I think you'll get more bang for your buck if you can be a bit more precise and actually hit the acupoints. Because that's in my experience been a very, very productive strategy with shoulder problems.
Brilliant. So a home level LED little laser machine.
Yeah, red stimulatory laser, but then hit the acupuncture points with it.
Thank you. That's a great idea. I love it.
Christine, get back to us and let us all know how you do.
I will. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Bye for now.
Bye bye.
And now on to our next email. This from Joe in Wisconsin. Joe writes, I first wanted to say that I'm a huge fan of your show. The information you provide is very detailed and helpful for someone who likes to learn and become more knowledgeable on health topics. Thank you. I am very much afraid of vomiting due to GI issues I've been experiencing most of my life. Therefore, especially during the winter months, I become very vigilant of hand washing and disinfecting, mainly due to the dreaded norovirus. I've researched this particular virus and associated illness, including ways to protect myself and others. I was wondering if you could expand on prevention measures, especially when traveling. I know there's some research into genetic or other natural immunity. Do you have any further information on this research? Do you have any knowledge or thoughts regarding the norovirus vaccine that's currently being researched and tested? So, Joe, I got to tell you, stay off cruise ships, all right? It's a closed environment. There's basically no escape once if something gets rolling. Furthermore, there are characteristics of this virus that are really bad from the standpoint of contagion. So, for example, very small particles. And in research studies, they have found that it takes as little as 18 virions, 18 virus particles to infect you with the virus. Now, that's just not very many particles. And the stuff is very small. It's a virus particle. It'll stay suspended in the air. So if someone has vomited in a bathroom on a cruise ship, then the norovirus is in the ventilation system because, of course, in bathrooms, you suck air out. And that air is going to recirculate. Some of those virions may possibly, very possibly, come out into the regular ventilation outside of the bathroom. So if you're in, and just even away from cruise ships, I'm going to make you paranoid. I'm going to make everybody paranoid. Sorry about that, but you asked. If you're in a bathroom and you hear somebody vomiting, what you want to do is take about 3 or 4 sheets of toilet paper, place it over your nose and mouth, breathe slowly and shallowly, and get the heck out of Dodge. You take care of your business somewhere else, but you do not want to remain in that space. And it's not because the sound of someone vomiting is going to make you vomit, although, prior to my medical training, that was a surefire cure way for me to make myself vomit. But now, of course, I am bulletproof on that one. But the mask, just an improvised little tissue paper mask, is going to reduce the chance that you inhale the stuff. It is very hard to clean off all of the surfaces that you might possibly touch. And that's why a contained environment is so much of a problem. Now, getting on to your questions about the vaccine, this has been a really difficult nut to crack. You know, you've heard me talk about flu viruses and how different strains there are. Well, there's 2 genogroups of norovirus. Actually, there's 5, but type 1 and type 2 are the ones that cause most human disease. Add them all together and you've got 31 different genotypes. So essentially, you're in a common cold situation where there's just too many various types and your immune system can't get itself immune to all of them. G24 strain is a single genotype. It's responsible for more than 70% of all human outbreaks since the mid-90s, and that's the one that's been targeted. But the problem with targeting is to make a vaccine, you really need an animal model. You need to be able to test it. Also, you need virus, and noroviruses do not replicate in tissue culture. Until recently, there wasn't an animal model. I think now they've got some kind of a genetically mutated rabbit. Basically, it's a Franken-rabbit. They did do research on primates, but that was stopped because it was considered to be really cruel to keep giving these monkeys diarrhea and vomiting. So, and it really is. So that's a problem, right? No animal model, so you can't test your proto-vaccine. Here's another problem. Human immunity doesn't last very long. So what you going to do with this vaccine? All right. So when I or you get norovirus, we make antibodies to it. The natural immunity that's testable, we can go and check and say, okay, well, how long do I keep making the antibodies? And the answer is, yeah, they're at high levels for about 2 years. Other research that's modeled epidemiologic data says, well, maybe it lasts 4 to 8 years. But that's based on some suppositions, and it may turn out to be the 2 years, which, in my view, is the better solid science in terms of how long we could expect it to work. So are we going to revaccinate the population with a vaccine every couple of years or just target the sicker people? And basically, none of the vaccines have really been at the level that we would want them to be. If you do modeling, in patients greater than 65 years old, which is the group that tends to get the sickest and the deadest from this, you'd need a vaccine that was more than 50% effective. It would need to last for at least a year, and it would result in preventing 200 cases and 4 hospitalizations for every 10,000 people you vaccinated. In children aged 0 to 4, you'd prevent 1,000 cases and 4 hospitalizations. So the question is cost effectiveness. Do we want to do this? And the other problem is the older you are or the younger you are, you're generally a poor responder to vaccines. So we might need a much more effective vaccine for it to work. So lots of technical issues with making this work. Takeda, it's a Japanese company, seems to have the best proto-vaccine that when I looked at the infectious disease website, it was still very definitely not ready for prime time. Let's shift gears for a moment, and I want to talk about heritage diets and chronic disease. This paper is from the Journal of the American Medical Association, December 17th, and it was an editorial, medical perspective, they're called. And I wanted to tell you first of all, about an organization called Old Ways. It's a Massachusetts-based nutrition nonprofit. And what they've done is they've created food pyramids and educational resources that are specific to a number of traditional diets. So they've got one for Mediterranean. They've got one for African, African, Asian diets, and Latin America, and we'll get into a little bit of the details. They have a cooking course, and they have licensed health coaches and ambassadors who actually do this. We're going to follow a woman named Deetra Dennis, who's a nurse, and she is a teacher for the African Heritage Diet. She teaches a 6-week cooking course, and it draws on an African heritage food pyramid. It's a plant-heavy diet with fruits, tubers, grains, beans, nuts, healthy oils, and seafood. What it doesn't have in it is a lot of fast food. So a typical U.S. diet, which includes some fast food, is high in fat, high in meat, low in fiber, fruits, and vegetables. It's also associated, of course, with weight gain and an increased risk of chronic disease. Turns out that unrefined carbohydrates like whole grains and tubers as the base of a meal with vegetables and some beans and maybe a little meat or fish for flavor is important. And I also want to throw out that these heritage diets do not use industrial processed oils. So, for example, sunflower seed oil, your safflower oil, these could not be made until the invention of industrial hydraulic presses to squeeze the oil out of these poor vegetables. And in this case, you know, safflowers or sunflowers, those their oils are in there, but they're locked into the tissues and there's no way to extract them. So primitive humans could never do it. What we're seeing is some really substantial dietary shifts. So a study of this group of African Americans using the diet we've just talked about, it's important. These were middle-aged African Americans, and they were given a traditional rural South African diet. And rural South Africans who were provided a westernized diet for 2 weeks. So the South African diet had about 50 grams of fiber a day and was low in fat and low in meat. And the Western diet had about 10 to 20 grams of fiber and was high in fat and meat. So in 2 weeks, the African Americans eating the South African diet had dramatic reductions in inflammation and biomarkers for colon cancer risk, while the opposite was true in the South African participants. And some of this is due to metabolites that are produced by the gut microbes. Your gut garden is actually processing what you eat and changing your risk of this and various other cancers. It's important to also understand, although it's not discussed here, the importance of epigenetics. And the study that was done in the Latin American traditional diet group really helps make that clear. In the traditional Mexican diet, they used a diet that was based on data from the 1940s, before westernized diets were popular. This included soups, fruits, vegetables, high in dietary fiber. The study produced the traditional diets from scratch, including the tamales and the tortillas. They didn't use the processed industrial food chain at all. And what they found was that the release of glucose and insulin resistance dropped drastically. And they also looked at immigrants from Mexico, and they found that the higher the percentage of indigenous ancestry, in other words, the closer you were to the Native American biologically, the bigger a difference it made. And that makes complete sense, because if you are a Mexican whose parents immigrated from Germany in 1940, you've got all that German epigenetics, which is really different. And that diet for hundreds of years included high levels of meat, and your body is more adapted to it. And you go to someone who's coming from a indigenous background genetically, they're used to starvation, they're used to squeezing every calorie out, and they are terribly sensitive to sugar and simple carbohydrates simply because they don't have the appropriate upregulation of the appropriate genes. And it takes 6 or 7 generations for someone to adjust genetically. So it's really important. Think about Mayans, for example. When you're treating, and as I have, when I ran the San Benito Health Foundation, low these many years, I was treating lots of people who had a lot of Mayan ancestry. They might have had some Inca, they had Aztec, and you could look at the faces and see the physiognomies that you can see carved into a wall at Palenque. So it's no surprise that that's the ideal diet. The same thing's also true with Asians, and particularly South Asians, like people from India and Pakistan, who come to the United States and begin eating a standard American diet, have drastically high levels of problems. But when you talk to them about changing their diet, don't tell them to eat salads. Say, go back to the diet you grew up with, but make a few adaptations. So instead of using white rice, use whole grain couscous because it has a lower glycemic index. When they went back and did the Asian diet, they had to go back to prior to the 1900s. That diet was high in ancient grains, low in meat, and low in refined carbohydrates. Are you getting the trend here? Eat a diet high in vegetables. Think of meat as a condiment. So what am I talking about? You don't eat more than a deck of cards worth of meat. And if you can eat half a deck of cards worth of meat, chop it up thinly and spread it throughout a dish of grain and vegetables, you're going to be doing yourself a great, great benefit. So the key take-home lessons here from all of these studies is use the culture, leverage the culturally appropriate diet. Don't tell people to all eat the Mediterranean diet if they didn't come from the Mediterranean. Leverage what they know, leverage what they are epigenetically adapted for, and make the little changes if you can. One of the suggestions I saw here, there's a very common Indian dish that's called paneer. Paneer is the cheese-like compound, and you can use tofu and make a paneer-tasting tofu and use that in saag paneer, and it's reduces the saturated fat. And if you're trying to work with someone who's already got problems, you can reverse it, but you can reverse it in a way that's comfortable to them. I'm not big on industrial natural foods. Like today at Costco, I was looking around at all of the industrial organic things that are, you know, supposed to be healthier and kind of going, well, okay, it's made with egg whites, but, you know, this is something I could make myself, and it's just learn to cook, folks. If you don't know how, ask somebody. Take a class. But it is a superpower, and it takes you from a consumer to a maker and provides a great deal of personal satisfaction. And there's a lot of tricks, even if you're very busy. You can reduce your overall cost for food and improve your health. So think about it anyway. Learn to cook. I am going to jump to our last email. This was going to be a little bit long. It is from Rob, who is sending it from Plettenberg Bay, South Africa. And Rob's another long-term listener, apparently. Here's what he writes. Dear Dr. Don, some 18 years ago, I wrote to you regarding my sudden intolerance to mammalian meat, which started it for me when my age was 26. It was diagnosed by you as being a result of a tick bite, and for which I am internally grateful. I have since been able to assist a female friend, age 65, who lives 100 kilometers away from me, who also has just become intolerant to mammalian meat, evidence of a growing problem. And by the way, folks, Quest has the mammalian meat antibody test. If you're having pain, rash, allergic reactions, and you think about it and go, hey, it's worse after that steak or roast beef, you might want to get yourself tested. It is associated with tick bites, and God knows we are sort of part of Tick Central in the United States. So something, parenthetical statement. Let's get back to Rob. This note to you is hopefully to obtain some relief for my wife, who has developed a, quote, rash over the past year. Background. We live in South Africa, and a year ago, my wife's 70-year, she was diagnosed with carcinoid neuroendocrine cancer, which has metastasized to her liver. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Despite a nuclear octreotide scan, the medical fraternity has been unable to establish the exact location of the carcinoid. From the 6-monthly CT scan and blood tests, they have established that the lesions have stabilized and the cancer cell count has reduced. The treatment that has been given is a monthly injection of sandostatin that will continue for the rest of her life. This is manufactured by Novartis. It's an octreotide. That is, folks, a growth hormone blocker. She does not have diarrhea, and her weight loss seems to have stabilized at 61 kilograms, but side effects. Before we do that, I do want to talk about what carcinoid is. So neuroendocrine tumors are a fascinating branch of endocrinology. Neuroendocrine means there are nerves and there are hormone-producing cells. So these are little glands, and they are scattered throughout our body as stem cells left over from our biological development in utero. And every now and then, you get a stem cell cancer, which is what these are. The problem is, it acts like a cancer, so it can spread to other tissues, not good, and it makes things. It manufactures, in the case of carcinoid, it manufactures serotonin. And one of the ways you diagnose it is by finding high levels of 5-HIAA in the urine, because that's the breakdown product of serotonin. So if you're making a lot of serotonin, it can be in your liver, it can be in other places in your body, and how the carcinoid syndrome manifests is all over the map. So this is a rare disease that is often misdiagnosed for a very, very long time. The most common symptoms are flushing, and anybody with flushing that's persistent might want to ask for that urine test. Especially common is diarrhea, particularly with the liver ones, and bronchospasms, so asthma attacks suddenly coming on. Flushing and asthma attacks that sort of look like an allergic reaction, you want to think about that. About 40% of people get abdominal pain. About 80% get the flushing and the diarrhea. A lot of them get spider veins, new spider veins, and they get rough skin rashes, but that's only about 5%. I want to read this wonderful quote. This is historical. Came across this today researching for this email. And this was Dr. William Bean. And this is in 1955, writing about the disease. This witch's brew of unlikely signs and symptoms, intriguing to the most fastidious connoisseur of clinical esoterica, the skin underwent rapid and extreme changes resembling in clinical miniature the fecal phantasmagoria of the aurora borealis. I'm wondering if that was a typo, if he actually said the fecal phantasmagoria, but I'm sorry, that's going to be my new curse word because I love it. Anyway, serotonin was identified in the early 50s. They also found that there are other compounds being released. And the flushing is, as I said, the most common thing. It's a facial flush. It's on the top of the body. It's one of these rare diseases that if you are listening to me and you get episodic flushing and episodic diarrhea, get yourself tested for this. You might actually have it. Not all of it is related to cancers that are going to metastasize. It depends on the location. This disease is literally all over the map, and I'm not even going to try to do more than just scratch the surface and tell you, yes, it's a thing. Now, getting on with the question here, we're not sure the exact timing of when this rash started, but it was fairly soon after the start of the monthly injections, and it's gotten progressively worse. Initially, the rash was on top of her feet, but recently has expanded to include her ankles and become like a short sock, although it is not on the soles of the feet. Her feet become hot, go red, get little pimples, and become terribly itchy and sore. This can happen whether her feet are down or up, in bed at night. It's definitely worse if she wears socks. We've tried antihistamines, cortisone, feet, and various creams. No good. But cold compresses or putting her feet in a bucket of cold water have the most relief. I have seen this once before, and I was never able to nail the diagnosis for this patient, and nor was anybody else. So I have to say that it seems like it would be related to the somatostatin. Obviously, you could stop it for skip a couple of injections and you would maybe get some of the other symptoms, but it would be really interesting to see if the rash got better. You need to establish whether this is a drug rash, because unfortunately it could be fixed drug eruption, and there's a 15% risk of rash with somatostatin. So if you can work with your doctor on that, skipping a dose might be a really interesting experiment. You also need to get this biopsied. There is a thing where the carcinoid goes to the skin, and it's called carcinoid erysipelas, and they tend to be very red, and they tend to be very discreet with a sharp cutoff. I can't see the rash, obviously, because the photos didn't come through, but I am wondering if that's a possibility. The somatostatin stuff, the octreotide, you know, not a great drug, because it does cause substantial side effects, but it's treating stuff that we don't have other good treatments for. It interacts with a lot of things, insulin, oral hypoglycemic beta blockers, bromocriptine. It can also interfere with absorption of nutrients. You want to be very careful with drugs that are metabolized by CYP3A4, and I recommend you go look that up, cytochrome, CYTOCHROME, CYP3A4. Look up the substrates. The list is as long as your arm, but that list needs to be carried in her pocket, because she is more likely to react to any pharmaceutical that goes through that pathway now that she's on the somatostatin. So you need to drive around the big tree in the middle of the road, which is this drug, and you may need to stay on the drug for life. There is one last therapeutic thing I want to talk to you about. If you're ever able to localize the tumors in the liver, there is a process called embolization, where they go in and they cut and they put little beads in there and they cut off the blood supply to the tumor. And it's very effective as a treatment, but you have to be able to localize it. So what I'm really hoping for you is that in the next 6 months, they find a way to localize the tumors and embolize the tumors, and that may get rid of the need for the somatostatin and help with all of your wife's issues. Thank you so much for triggering a walk on the wild side in terms of this rare but extremely interesting disease. I'll be revisiting it in my ancient textbook of internal medicine, because it hasn't changed that much, and also looking online at my favorite resource, which is eMedicine, to make sure that I'm up to date on that. And I'm going to call that woman that I could never diagnose and have her get tested for 5-HIAA, because I'm really wondering now if I missed the boat on that one. And it is, alas, time for us to say goodbye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.